But let's try doing this together. It's 11 verses, and it's from Psalm 95. Let's read together. Come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout aloud to the rock of our salvation. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol him with music and song. For the Lord is a great God, the great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth, and the mountain peaks belong to him. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Come, let us bow down and worship. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture, the flock under his care. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did at Meribah, as you did that day at Massah in the desert, where your fathers tested and tried me, though they had seen what I did. For 40 years I was angry with that generation. I said, they are a people whose hearts go astray, and they have not known my ways. So I declared on oath in my anger, they shall never enter my rest. Amen. You may be seated. Great job. We're in the middle of a series on spiritual disciplines. And again, I want to start off with a little bit of a reflection, thinking about spiritual disciplines. What is it? How do we practice it? Why should we do this? And I thought about a movie reference, again, to kind of help me out. How many of you guys remember the movie Armageddon? Not particularly biblical, but it has a biblical name. Armageddon. That was like 10 years ago already, okay? But the basic plot, even if you haven't seen it, is that there was this gigantic asteroid, right, that is hurtling toward Earth, a planet killer, they call it. And the solution that all of the brightest minds of the Earth, they get together, and the solution is that they, instead of sending up like scientists or the military types, that they would send up oil drillers. You guys remember this? Okay. Headed by Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck, because they know how to drill really deep. Because you have to drill really deep so that the bomb could penetrate the surface of the asteroid and drill it in deep for it to do any real damage. Okay, you guys remember this? I know, it's a real plausible scenario, right? Anyways, the idea is that even a most powerful explosive, even an amazingly powerful explosive, left on the surface will have virtually no real impact, right? But if you want deep impact, which was in fact the name of another movie about an asteroid, but if you want deep impact where it can do some real damage, you need to drive it to the core, right? One way of thinking about spiritual disciplines is like this. It is possible for us to have this explosive thing called faith and leave it surface deep. It is possible for us to call ourselves Christians, be baptized, go to church, and have everything function at a very surface, superficial level. You can say, I believe, and say all the right things, but have it touch very little of our hearts and our action, our being, our person, how we make choices, what we value. We can have faith, but we can have it have very little impact. And our lives are hardly transformed. Our lives are hardly changed. And sadly, this is a real plausible scenario. All right? We've seen it in others, and we've seen it in ourselves. The way in which historical Christianity has understood how this process by which our faith gets driven into our core, the way in which this powerful thing called faith gets driven into our hearts where it can do some real damage, real transformation, real breaking up of stuff that's hardened, is through the practice of spiritual disciplines. And this is why this is so important. This is why you should pray. This is why you should meditate on Scripture and listen and solitude and all of these things. Not because those things make God like you more. Not because those things will somehow get you more blessings in your life. But because it is the way in which faith gets driven into our hearts. Okay? So today we're going to learn about the practice of worship. What it is and how it should be done. And we're going to be reflecting on Psalm 95. Which is one of the classic texts on worship. And in fact, it's one of these texts. If you go to a church that is more, Pastor Sam used the word liturgical, which is high church, like lots of standing up and down. And if you go to those traditions, Psalm 95 has a name of its own. It's called the Venite, means to come in Latin, because it's that famous, it's that classic. So that's what we're going to study from. And we're going to think about worship, hopefully in a more meaningful way. Let me begin by throwing out a definition of worship to you guys. And this is one that is accepted by many people. It's not something that's original to me. I think Pastor Sam may have said in an earlier time something very similar to it as well. But worship is this. Worship is ascribing the ultimate value to something and engaging your mind, your heart, and your will, every part of your being as you do it. Worship is to ascribe something the ultimate value in your life and to engage that thing, that object of your worship, with all of your mind, your heart, your will, whatever aspect that includes your entire person. So first thing I want to talk about is that worship engages the entire person. Let's look at Psalm 95 together. Verses 1 to 2 starts off by talking about singing with joy. Singing with joy. It talks about shouting loudly. And these aren't like metaphorical shouting loudly. I always get stuck on this because I grew up in a tradition. I was talking to Ray about the tradition that we both have in common, where if it said kneel in the song, we would kneel, okay? If it said dance, we would dance. We took these things literally. Now, sometimes, and it's not that those things make it more pure or that is the only way to do it, but sometimes I always thought it's like, you know, I always thought it was a little funny when people talked about, you know, we lift our hands and people like this. Like, it's, we clap our hands together to you and you're singing really loud, but you're like this. Like, you know, words are not just poetic and metaphorical. Sometimes they are actual actions. And here it talks about singing with joy, let us shout aloud. And they would shout. And there would be an actual shouting. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol him. Extol, I actually had to look that up. And went, well, I think I know what it is. But it's praise exuberantly. It's not just praise, it's exuberantly. So there's this energy involved, there's this emotion involved. This is singing and shouting and praising with feeling and emotions affectively for the psychology majors among you guys, okay? Now let's move to verses 6 to 7. So we worship with our feelings. We worship on the emotional level. Verses 6 to 7, there's this bowing and kneeling in worship. We bow down, we kneel before the Lord. In worship, what does that mean? Because sometimes we just leave it as, well, it's just what you do. No, it means to submit to someone. It is to submit your will, right? It is to say, you know what, I am going to not just say you're cool, but I'm going to obey what you say. You're actually going to have authority over my life. In worship, you're supposed to give your life, make changes to your life. So worship is not a passive experience of just gathering information and say, you know, that's really, really interesting. I'll think about it. You leave it at that level, it's not worship because it misses this part in which it engages the will. So in every Sunday worship, we're asked to change, to submit, to obey to the will of God, right? So worship, it requires the bowing down of your will. And then verses 7, the last part of 7, it says, the next part of 7 goes, today if you hear, there's this thing about, and God actually speaks. It's actually God speaking in the first person toward the end of Psalm 95 that we'll get into later on in the sermon. But this is listen and hear, and listening and hearing always involves understanding and engaging your mind, right? So even here in this little psalm, there are aspects of emotion, there are aspects of our will, there are aspects of our mind that's engaged in worship. Emotion, will, and mind. And worship, every single part of your human being, of your personhood, has to be engaged. In fact, worship is not worship. I will say it like this. Worship is not worship unless it engages the entire person, unless it engages your entire being. Okay? And this is what Jesus is talking about when he says in Luke 10, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with your soul, your strength, and your mind. Worship is not worship if you just choose to say, I'm going to do it with all of my soul or all of my heart. But I'm not going to do this head stuff or the emotion stuff. I'm just not wired like that. This is not for us to all become emotionally, react to certain things emotionally the same way, okay? Some of us, I'll pick on my wife a little bit. When we're watching, like, sometimes ESPN, you know, and we see a story about a basketball player who's hurt, she'll start crying. You know, so she reacts very emotionally just like that. She'll react to certain things very emotionally, okay? Me, I'm just, you know, it could be like, it's almost kind of like a challenge. Like, you'll never just, man, I'm just like, it's, you know, I think I have muscles on my tear ducts or something. It's like, so I try to work on that because even if I feel it, I don't want to show it. Okay? So we react to things emotionally differently, and we react to certain things in our minds differently. We get that. We get that. Okay, so this is not for us to say that we must all uniformly raise our hands like this. We must all uniformly react to emotion a certain way. That's one of the most important things about getting to know another person in relationships, whether it's in friendship or in marriage, that we react differently. But worship requires for us to never shut off an aspect of our lives to God. It engages the entire person. That means this. If you're engaging with the truth of God's scripture, if you're learning stuff about God and you love learning stuff about God, but you have never let that truth, you have never reflected upon God in such a way, you have never thought about God's beauty in such a way that it had melted your heart and has broken you to tears. And whether that's openly weeping, like going, you know, or just, you know, going, I don't know. I don't know what that looks like for you. But if you have never experienced that, or if you have, if you say you believe, but you don't feel the need ever to shout joyfully, if you say you know, or the other way is if you worship and your main concern about how do I feel? Am I experiencing? How am I feeling? Oh, man, I'm really getting into it. And it's mainly about your emotions, but there is no bowing down or kneeling in your life. All of the other combinations, then you have not completely worshiped. Worship is when we worship with all aspects of our being. It engages the entire person. True worship takes our beliefs and drives it down into our hearts. Okay. Secondly, worship is, as we said, ascribes the ultimate value in something. Worship is when we ascribe the ultimate value. Once again, let's look at Psalm 95 to see how this gets done. There's a little preposition in Psalm 95, and it might not be as obvious from looking at the screens, but if you have your Bibles before you, there's a little preposition. Now, you have to remember, for some of you guys, what a preposition is. But it's the word that doesn't fit all the other categories of noun, verb, and all that stuff. It occurs twice in the passage, and it shows what triggers real worship. Any guesses as to this little preposition? Is looking at the passage. That's right, it's for. The word for, okay? The hint, let me just give it to you guys, okay? It's for. Okay, look at it in the context. Come, let us sing for the Lord. Let us shout aloud for the Rock of Valley salvation. Let us come before him with thanksgiving and extol him with music and song. For the reason is because the Lord is a great God, the great King above all gods. Let me place you at the highest place. In his hands are the depths of the earth going low. The mountain peaks at the highest belong to him. Everything is covered by this great God who's a great King above all gods. The sea is his hands formed, and the wetness of the earth as well as the dry lands. Come, let us worship him by now, and let us kneel before the Lord our God, our maker. He just talked about the grandness of God, right? And now in verse 7, he now goes to 4. Again, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture. The personalness of God, how close he is. And we are the flock under his care. We are the sheep under his care. Big and small, and huge and heights and lows, wet, dry, all of these things. The psalmist is saying, and you can just feel him, he's just meditating upon how just amazing God is. He's just thinking and pondering, he's chewing, and he's just dwelling on this, and he's treasuring this up, and it's just building up and welling up in such a way that he explodes with worship. And he says, come, let us worship the Lord, our God, our maker. You could just see how this happens as he understands the greatest value, the amazing excellencies, the amazing attributes, the greatness and the love and the beauty of God that he's worshiping, he loves. He breaks out with his entire being in worship, in adoration, in acclaim, shouts with his mind. His life explodes. Broken apart in meaningful ways in worship. Now, one of the assumptions that the psalmist has, and indeed throughout the Bible, one of the assumptions about worship is that we are always worshiping. We are, all human beings, are either worshiping God or worshiping something else. Think about how the Ten Commandments are phrased. The first of the Ten Commandments, what does that Ten Commandment go? It's about worship, right? It says, you shall have no other gods before me. No other gods. It doesn't say you shall have no other gods. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say you shall not even acknowledge other gods. You shall only acknowledge me. He doesn't say that. He says, you shall have no other gods before me. I don't think this is just to be clear, this is not some sort of acknowledgement of a polytheistic understanding of the universe. That would not be possible within the Hebraic understanding here. But the command assumes something about human nature, which is that we are worshiping beings. Now, this might be a little bit of a surprise, and this might even sound a little bit strange because you guys are going, well, I got friends that don't worship anything. I got friends, they don't believe in God, nevertheless worship anything. They mock people who worship. I don't worship. I'm not religious. I don't bow down to anything. But that's just not true. Everybody builds their lives, gives their hearts, sets their hope, ascribes the ultimate value to something. Because why? You have to live for something. We all worship something. You have to find meaning in something, your career, your lover, your family. Some of you guys are chuckling because I said lover. Professional acclaim, some sort of success or bank account or material, a stamp collection. I don't know what it is, but there is something that you say, if I really have that, then my life is worth something. If I have that, if I achieve that, if I get that in my life, then I am worth something. We all have this. This is actually given to us. That understanding is made clear when we think about the word worship itself. From the you know, sometimes when you do the etymologies, it gives you a greater understanding of the wisdom of some of the people who came up with these words. Worship, of course, comes from the ancient Old English word for worth-ship or worth-shape, as in something that you consider of worth that shapes you. Worth. The idea is that to worship was to be shaped by something, to be shaped by the worth of something. Worship is to look at something and say that that is so valuable, that is so worth it, that if I had that, if I was able to possess that somehow, then I am worth something. You're being shaped by the worth of something. And everybody does that. We're all shaped by what we find worth of the ultimate value. And the psalmist is saying that if you want to change your life, then you have to take your heart off whatever you are worshiping. And you've got to turn that to God. That's what the psalmist is saying about worship. Now, let me try to illustrate right now the worship problem that exists for many of us Christians, for far too many Christians. The problem of worship. Gene, actually, you could put up that picture that I asked you to get ready. A couple of months ago, I read this article about a medieval painting. In 1998, this painting by an unknown, at that time, an unknown Renaissance artist, probably Renaissance artist, was purchased for $19,000. 1998, not that far ago. In 2007, the owner bought it for investment. In 1998, the owner bought it for investment. It sat mostly in storage, in cellar somewhere most of that time. They weren't really sure about who did it. So in 2007, the owner didn't think much of this painting and sold it, decided to sell it for $19,000. Not much of a return on investment, but at least he didn't have a loss. You know, it's an art world. I guess, you know, you're taking a lot of risks in investment. Now, the new owner of this painting thought this painting reminded him of works by another famous Renaissance artist, and sent it off to some experts to have it examined and tested. Anybody see this, read this article as well? Nobody else is familiar? Okay, it's going to be cool. Breaking news. The forensic art expert who examined this, you know, he gets dozens of these requests to look through art. And $19,000, not a huge amount of money in the art world. Look through it. Well, you know, he gathered his stuff, looked through it, and noticed, you know, the way the brush strokes and the style and the techniques by a left-handed painter and all of these things were consistent with a painter, a little-known painter by the name of Leonardo da Vinci. So he had I don't even know what it is. I'm just going to throw out the word, but it's a multispectral image. I'm not exactly sure what that requires, but he had a multispectral image made of this painting, and in it, in the upper left-hand corner, found a fingerprint of Leonardo da Vinci, a known fingerprint that matched to a known fingerprint of his. The new estimate of this painting is $150 million, okay? I mean, and not only that, this is setting the art world on fire because you do not find unknown Leonardo da Vinci paintings, you know, every day. This is a once in a lifetime. Now, imagine with me the reaction of some of the people that would be involved here. First, think about the owner who let it go for $19,000, who had it sit in his cellar, I don't know, next to the wedding pictures that we have. I don't know, next to the, the cases of, you know, Diet Coke that he got at Costco. I don't know. I'm just thinking, $19,000. You know, it's reasonable. Many of us could have bought this for $19,000. You know, it's not. It would have bankrupted some of us a little bit or emptied our savings account. But gosh, we could have had something for $19,000 on public sale, but, you know, we wouldn't have known its worth. It could have been life-changing for this person, not just to have something go up from $19,000 to $150,000, but this would be the story that he would tell at every single dinner party. Oh, yes, I found a Leonardo da Vinci once. Bought it for $19,000. Yes. But it didn't. That didn't happen that way. He didn't know its true worth. So he possessed this thing. It didn't change his life. It didn't transform anything about his life. And in fact, it transformed him as the biggest idiot in the world because he didn't think to do the multispectral imaging. He had possessed this thing of this amazing worth, but he didn't know it. Now imagine the art expert now who was asked to look at the piece. He gets asked to look at this stuff all the time, but imagine as he just slowly looks at it and goes, yeah, that reminds me of Leonardo. And he starts looking at it and just starts taking a little magnifying glass, because I imagine that that's what they do. They'll take a little magnifying glass and go, wow, this is consistent. And he looks up some textbooks and he goes, wait, this woman's ear looks just like something else in this. And he compares notes and he goes, wait a second, and he starts, you imagine, this is just beginning to consume him, and he can't think about anything else. It gets the multispectral images done, and he's waiting for the results, and he's just consumed by it, and somebody says it's dinner time, and he's like, dinner time? Are you kidding me? I want to know the results of this thing. And he's looking through when the image is comes back for fingerprints, and he's looking through, to see for any known marks, and he finds the fingerprint, and he looks through his files, and he starts comparing one by one, one by one, one by one, and he can't hardly contain his excitement, and he finds a match. His entire life, right? His mind, his emotions, everything has changed because he has now known, he has discovered the value of something, right? And this is what he's going to do when he meets the owner, the new owner of the art, who has no idea that this has happened, goes up and says, you are the luckiest woman alive. And she has no idea what he's talking about. He's like, what do you mean? He's like, do you know who painted this? No, I don't. That's why I got you. I'm paying you for this stuff. And she's going, well, what's it going to be? I mean, well, this could be pretty good. And she's aware that, you know, the conclusive evidence is really, really hard in this stuff. But to say I found a fingerprint, and she just... He's telling her the good news. He's telling her he's evangelizing to her, right? And slowly, as she's uptaking this information, her life is transformed. Her life is completely blown up. You know what the Bible is saying? For an awful lot of us, the reason why we say we believe, we confess all the right things, and it's not a lie, but the reason why the rest of our lives are not being touched by this is because we are like that fool who possessed this thing of immeasurable wealth and just left it there in the cellar. That's our condition. Transformation hasn't happened because we have never really gotten down to worshiping giving the ultimate value, knowing the ultimate worth, knowing the amazing worth of this God whom we possess. Transformation hasn't happened because we don't know the discipline of what the psalmist is doing. We don't know how to worship. We think we do. We use the word all the time. But that is what we must do. We're all shaped by something. And this is why this is so important. Look, we have a worship problem in our hearts. Look, do you know the reason why it's so hard for us to love our neighbor? Do you know the reason why it's so hard for us to be satisfied in what we have? Do you know the reason why we're still coveting? Do you know the reason why it's so hard for us to stop lying and cheating to protect our reputation or give justified excuses for whatever it is in our lives? It's because there's something else. There's something else that we're saying besides God, that we're saying, I gotta have that. But if I have that, because if I have that, then I will find my worth. So you've got to have your reputation, because that's more important to you, because you've got to have your job, you've got to have your money, you've got to have your career. We lie, not because we want to, but because we find something else of more value. There's a real problem that there's something besides God in our lives that we're looking at and saying, in our hearts, we're saying, if I have that, then I am worth something. We're being shaped by a worship of something else than God. Because if you really valued His love, if you really valued Him over everything else, if you really valued His approval over the approval of anyone else, if you really valued God's approval, then when someone criticizes you, or when you face rejection, or when you go through a breakup, or a loss, or go through a financial crisis, those things would be hard. That would be very, very hard. But it would not devastate you. All our problems come from, what do we worship? What does our heart ascribe as the highest of worth? Until you learn to treasure God, because we spend a whole lot of time daydreaming about other things. But until you can start to treasure and daydream about who God is, until we begin to worship Him in all of our being, we're not going to change. Because if you want to change your life, you change who or what you worship. And that's the secret. You change what you worship. How do we worship? I don't have a whole lot of time, but I want to talk about how we worship, because that's critical too. And I want to just go through that really, really quickly, and I'll cover some of this stuff, probably return to it at a later time, but I just want to throw out to you, at least in this context, in Psalm 95, at least three elements of proper worship and how we do that. One aspect of proper worship, Psalm 95, let's go back to verse 1. But you could stay at verse 6, verse 1, verse 6, verse 2, all of these things. It's all plural. It's come, let us worship. I challenge you to find a passage in the Bible that says, come, let me worship. Our faith is deeply personal. This is the saying. Our faith is deeply personal, but it's never private. Okay, it's a huge difference. There's a sense in which sometimes we think gathering here is kind of like going to see a movie, as in, everybody please be quiet, turn, I want to just have my moment, I want to connect to God. Please don't distract me. But there's a sense in which the psalmist is saying, come, let us worship. It says our faith is deeply plural. It's always us. And it's a real us, real faces, not just generic us. Because that's easy. I could always do generically, I will worship with other people. But then if it gets down into, I will worship with actual concrete faces in the crowd that you're going to see and that you get to know and that you actually, they know you, that they're going to count, you know, they're going to hold you accountable for what you actually do with your life and what you're not being consistent about. That's a little bit harder because you can't get away with just looking like you worship anymore, right? But there's something more important than just accountability when it comes to worship. But the whole idea, really, the corporate idea of worship, that it's, worship is always plural, is that to think that we have the whole vision of God completely to ourselves, that we don't need the help of others to see different aspects of who God is, that is just preposterous if you think about it. I mean, one of the advices that pastors will give to young couples when they're asking about, you know, we're getting pretty serious in our dating relationship. We're wondering maybe if we're thinking about marriage. What are some things that you know, you can help me with that to make sure that I know that this is the right person? Some of you guys' ears are perking up right now. And one of the things that we say all the time is, see that person in all different environments. See that person in terms of how that person reacts and is with his friends, with his parents and his family, not just with you, okay? Because you hear stories all the time on a very practical level of just somebody who's very different one-on-one. And is just loving and writes you all these letters and is just pays all the attention. But as soon as you get to somewhere else, he's completely different. But you also know friends, and you see friends in a very powerful way when you see them interact with other people, and you go, wow, that's kind of cool. You know, there's a friend that I thought, you know, he's good at this, and that's why I like him. But now I see him in another situation, and I see him shining in another situation. And that's an aspect that I've never seen in my relationship with him. That's a cool thing. And the way God is going to be with us, the way God interacts with Myung, the way God interacts with Jerry, the way God interacts with Young, those things are going to fill out my understanding, my image of who God is. We need that. We need that because we don't have the ability to capture, not by ourselves, all of who God is. Are you guys getting me on this? That is impossible for us to fathom who God is unless we have the help of others. We can't even begin to fathom who God is if we thought about it just purely on private terms. And God always calls upon us to be in community for that reason. Okay? That's part of the reason why we gather like this. That's part of the reason why we think this is so important. 80% of the American, 80% of Americans say that you can be a good Christian and not go to church. You could just, I don't know, just watch on the internet or, you know, just watch TV or just kind of just not have a community body. And it's just the furthest thing from the truth. Okay? Second thing that I want for us to notice. The first thing is we worship corporately. The second thing I want for us to notice about how we worship. This is a little bit harder. And I'll make my point, I think, throughout these months, but especially next week as well. We just talk about the Sabbath a little bit. But there is a rhythm to this. Did you guys just notice this? Some of you guys are more keen on these kind of rhythm things. Some of you guys just have more rhythm than others. It's true. Even in psalm reading, right? Did you guys notice that? Even in the psalm, as we read it together, there's a rhythm that we can capture? Okay, how many people are like completely oblivious to this? It starts off, come, let us worship let us sing for joy to the Lord. And then again, there's a repetition of come once again. And there's a rhythm into the deeper things. And it's a beautiful thing. Just read it several times. The only way I can describe rhythm is to say it's a regular, expected interval of things. But I can't, what am I going to do, dance for you? That you do not want. But what you do want to do is just spend time just reading this. You don't even have to worry about, am I capturing all the words? Just try to see how it flows. There's a rhythm to the actual words as well and the meaning. There's a rhythm in the sense of it starts off by talking about, again, what I said before about the emotion. There's a will, and there's also the mind that's engaged, and there's this boom, boom, boom. And all of these things are engaged in our emotions and our will and our minds. And that's complete worship. Now, I'm going to confess to you guys, one of the things that Pastor Sam and I talked about this, this is going on to 3 or 4 months that we're talking about this and saying, and we had conversations about this with the leadership board as well, that we want to capture more of a sense of rhythm throughout our worship, our Sunday worship, this time we gather together. You know, we have it at times, but sometimes we have not paid enough attention to it. In fact, Pastor Sam talked about the rhythm of the Christian calendar, of the year. And that's part of the reason why we want to capture that and we want to do this Lenten practice. This is something that captures us to say that, you know what, God is to be praised at regular intervals together with all aspects of our being. And our worship together in rhythm. Here's the thing about the rhythm. This is the final thing that I want to say about rhythm, is that it has to be taken as a whole, because rhythm doesn't make sense if you just take apart the beat, take apart one beat and isolate it. Right? Right? There's no rhythm. There's no rhythm. And now you're just that awkward person dancing your life to the downbeat, only, you know? What does that mean? That means we have to get over our bad habit that we sometimes develop, that we prioritize different aspects of this service over others, right? Because we feel sometimes like, you know, the praise part, which is a little bit too emotional for me, I'm not really into that, but I want to just come in for the sermon part, because that part, it makes sense for me. The whole welcome thing, and I'm not exactly connecting with that participation thing, so I'm not going to really, you know, be into that, but I'm going to be into the announcement part. I don't know. And we want to develop a more of a rhythm, and this is a challenge for us, and this is something that I'm confessing to you guys, that we need to do a better job of giving you a more rhythmic worship experience. But that is for us to say, look, how do we say this nicely? If you have consistently zoned out on some parts of our worship, if you have considered praise just a prelude music, a walking music, you need to reconsider that. Tell us and help us to figure out how to make that more meaningful. Yes. Tell us and help us to make it, to help you, help me, help you. But the option for us is not to say, you know, I'm just going to come in time for the sermon, instruction. You're not, worshiping is not instruction. You don't change through information. Your life is transformed by worship and engagement of your entire being. And that's what we're trying to do. Okay? That's what we're trying to do. The third thing I want to say, and we'll talk about that more. We'll just leave it at that. But the third thing I want to say is that there's this entire thing at the very end. If you get to verse 6, right? Next one, actually. Last part of verse 7 and verse 8. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as you did at Meribah. This is entire thing. It goes through and go through the last part. And they shall never, enter my rest. And there's this thing about worship, true worship, that gives rest. Okay? This thing of entering into his rest, and this is a key phrase that gets picked up throughout the Bible. Jesus talks about entering and receiving his rest. And in Hebrews 4, it doesn't, I can't do a good job of this right now, but it talks about entering into his rest because many of us, even though we have God, we're still walking around as if we have our burdens on our back. And in faith, we have faith. There's a sense in which we have faith, but we're still burdened because we're still trying to find our worth in our own goodness, in our own ability to be a good conservative, to be a good liberal, to be a good whatever label you want to put on ourselves, but we're failing to worship, which is to completely give over our entire being, all aspects of our being, and say someone is the highest. And Jesus, in response to this, says, come. Once again, come. All you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. The secret of worship, the impossible secret of worship is this, that Jesus comes down to us and finds us of such value. He thinks about us and he treasures us and he ponders about our condition, each and every one of us, in a personal way. In a personal way, not a private way. But he thinks about every one of us and he considers us of such value that he finds it of absolute worth. And he's shaped by our condition. He willingly suffers, willingly dies. And he gives us new life. And when we begin to realize just how much he looks at our lives and says, that is worth something to me, then we can begin to treasure God and Christ in such a way that we can say, I will find my rest. I will stop running around trying to find my rest in something else, on my own design. I will find it in him alone. And there you will find rest. And then there you'll find worship. That's the secret of worship. And if you know the secret of worship, your life will change. Would you bow your heads with me? And we're going to close out today, as you would think would be very appropriate, with a response time in worship. And I just ask you that you would use this time as a time in which you would engage your heart, your mind. Think about what God is saying to you. But you would also engage your will and submit before him and kneel down before him.